Andrew Young's resume is impressive by anyone's standards. He was a prominent civil rights leader and aide to the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., represented Georgia in the U.S. Congress, was the first African-American U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, served two terms as mayor of Atlanta, and was co-chairman of the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta. But in a new book he's written with Kabir Sehgal, his godson, Mr. Young cites mentoring young people as one of the most important things he's done in his life. In their book, called Walk in My Shoes, the two men who were born some 50 years apart discuss how their lives and their ideas have intersected. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan, and I'm very pleased that it brings Andrew Young and Kabir Sehgal to our show today. Hi.
Very good.
Thank you.
Kabir, aren't you an investment banker at J.P. Morgan?
Right.
What do you do there?
Well, I advise institutional clients to where to put their money in emerging markets. So in Africa in particular, the Middle East, Russia. And so that's I'm giving advice and providing research opportunities to investors.
Did your godfather encourage you to pursue a career in banking?
He did, indeed. I actually got into banking kind of by reverse. I was trying to start a company in India and I needed to finance it somehow. So I took a job in London and sent my paychecks to India and the company kind of fizzled. We ran out of money and I'm glad I'm stuck at a great investment bank, the last bank to really stand. And I came to Uncle Andy and I said, listen, you guys should work in banking. And he's always encouraged me to go into banking and he's learned principles of high finance. So, yeah, and I know banking has a bad name these days, but only a few years ago, Muhammad Yunus, a banker, won the Nobel Prize. So you can use high principles of finance for great causes.
Well, I'm not sure that I can address you as Uncle Andy. I don't know whether I should say mayor, congressman, ambassador.
Or just Andy, anything.
I understand that you also encouraged one of your own daughters to become a banker.
Well, and she wouldn't. She decided that she would go into basically public purpose law. And she really worked in capital punishment in Georgia, which is as depressing as you can get, for 3 or 4 years. And then she worked with Ted Kennedy, Senator Kennedy, in his office as an Africa kind of consultant, and went to Africa with him and met Winnie Mandela. And she decided she wanted to work with Africa, and she stayed there. And our church, the United Church of Christ, has lots of missionary colleges, and she took over the job of sort of supervising the colleges and missions of Africa for our church. So she's had a distinguished career, but it's been a nonprofit career.
Well, where do you think you can make the most impact? In politics, in business, in religion?
All of the above. And what I've tried to do is integrate them. I start where I end up. I figure in the day of judgment, I'm going to be asked, did I feed the hungry? Did I clothe the naked? Did I heal the sick? Did I set at liberty those who were oppressed? Well, I started preaching about that, and that wasn't good enough. And then I realized that politics in the South was preventing people from being God's children, because they were put in the back as second-class citizens, and they were humiliated. So I got into the civil rights movement, but we desegregated public accommodations, and we got the right to vote. But Dr. King's motto was to redeem the soul of America from the triple evils of racism, war, and poverty. Now, when it comes to poverty, that's understanding money. And I realized I didn't understand money. And I encourage my children, all four of them, to try to understand how to make capitalism work for poor people it does for the rich and the middle class.
So creating jobs is more important in some ways than creating charitable programs?
Well, I would like to see charitable programs become somehow self-sustainable. And I think that's what Muhammad Yunus did in Bangladesh. But it's also what a number of philanthropists are trying to do. One of the stories I talk about in the book is a friend of mine who owned the Dollar General, which is a store for basically neighborhoods. And he wanted to give money to a black organization. And I said, no, don't give money to a black organization. Take the money you're going to give and decide to start a Dollar General in a black community that has no good department store. Train a black manager, hire black people from that community, and help them to develop a sustainable business. I now notice almost everywhere I go around the South, Dollar Generals are popping up in the black community.
You also mentioned like working at McDonald's is kind of like an MBA program, right?
Well, my son always said he wanted to understand money. And I said, well, okay, get a job at McDonald's for a summer, for a year. If you understand customer service, if you understand managing inventory, if you understand quality control, by running a McDonald's for a year, you probably learn as much about business as you will get in an MBA. And most of the young black millionaires I know are people who didn't have a chance to go to college or go get a master's or a graduate degree. They started out hustling, most of them in the fast food business, and then they migrated into other opportunities.
So you say in the book that you admire Muhammad Yunus more than you do Bill Gates, who's used his money to fund AIDS research rather than create jobs.
Well, I do and I don't. You know, I mean, remember, I'm
both are necessary.
No, I'm talking to a young man who's 50 years my junior, and I'm telling him, don't wait till you get rich like Bill Gates and then give your money away. Find a way. Muhammad Yunus started as a young professor, helping poor women, beggar women who couldn't read and write, to have $25, $50 loans. And he discovered by talking with these poor people that each one of them had something that could be determined as a business plan. And what I've tried to do is to get this younger generation to integrate charity and commerce.
What's your rub against Bill Gates?
My rub against Bill Gates was that he had a lot of money, and he got a lot of smart, rich people like himself to decide what to do with it. And I don't know that they talked enough to the poor.
See, I would submit to you that Bill Gates has done a lot in third world countries. He has software to work with governments, and he's made a whole heck of a lot of people rich beyond belief.
It sounds to me like you're talking about something like trickle-down economics, aren't you?
No, I'm not talking about I think that's trickle-down economics. What I was talking about with the AIDS drugs, for instance, that they were giving people antiretrovirals who didn't have food and water. And antiretrovirals will kill you. I mean, they were designed for people who eat, 1,500 calories a day. And these were people who had 1,500 calories in a week. And so it started out, but even somebody whom I love and admire more than anybody else in the world is Jimmy Carter. But I was wishing that instead of just dealing with guinea worm as, one little filter at a time, and I think if he'd been president another term, we'd have done this together. Why not develop a water purification system and have everybody with clean, fresh water? And with the amount of money that Bill Gates has, I think that he could do both. But I also believe that charity should be self-sustaining. And it shouldn't be just somebody giving you money. When the money runs out, the project runs out. You should design the projects in such a way that if your money runs out, they can still continue the project.
This has been a major criticism of the kind of aid that we've given to poor countries in Africa and elsewhere. So you're not alone in feeling this way. My guests are
it's constructive criticism. I admire people like Bill Gates and President Carter more than anybody in the world, but I expect them to be at the top of their game in charity just as they were in computers or in politics.
My guests are Andrew Young and Kabir Sehgal, Sehgal. Their book is Walk in My Shoes, Conversations Between a Civil Rights Legend and His Godson on the Journey Ahead. It has a foreword by Bill Clinton. Segal, oh, and this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Segal, will you tell us how the idea for this book came about?
It really started perhaps, well, let me go back to about 20 years ago when I was trying to start a school newspaper in elementary school, and I couldn't get it passed or approved in my elementary school. And my father and Uncle Andy worked together. And
was he already your godfather?
Well, yeah, and it was kind of an organic thing that came about. And we kept on talking, and I said, would you sit down for this interview, please? And he said, sure. So I went back to the elementary school principal. I said, well, our first interview will be with Ambassador Andrew Young. So we sat down, and so over the many, many years, through my weird teenage years, I would go to him, ask questions, and through my college years, I would come to him. And then on my college graduation day, he came up to Hanover to be with me, and his wife, Carolyn, did as well. And he gave me a letter, and in the letter, he kind of wrote some general advice, but some advice that was specific to me, saying, like, you know, keep your head down and give other people credit. And I thought that was a great opening salvo of what a book of wisdom. And the reason I think I was so fortunate, I've been blessed, I've been overeducated and overfinanced my entire life, and I have this great opportunity to be, you know, in a close proximity to Uncle Andy, a living legend. And you know, when you go read those books like Mark Twain and Ralph Waldo Emerson, you keep on reading them again and you get more and more lessons. And I thought maybe if we can transcribe these interviews together, I could come back 20, 30 years from now and learn something again for the first time.
Well, you've written it in your own voice, but you quote Uncle Andy extensively. Right. Was it challenging to develop a structure for this material?
That was probably the biggest challenge. It was, where do I fit in this book? And I was, you know, I came to that decision with great trepidation to put his words in my voice. And he said, I said, you know, no one really cares what I think. And he said, well, no, that's not true. He said, you know, you need to develop your own opinion. And I went from him being kind of a ventriloquist for me and to developing my own voice. And you see, like, we challenge each other in the book, and he says a lot of kind of controversial and uncomfortable things. And the book kind of wrote itself. I know it's cliche, but it certainly did.
Well, Andy, you've said that it's a mentor's responsibility to challenge the person he's mentoring, to sometimes take him out of his comfort zone. Has Segal ever turned the tables on you and taken you out of your comfort zone?
He tries. And he does sometimes. One, he's far better read in economics and banking than I am. And so when we start talking about the present crisis, and he starts talking about derivatives and credit default swaps and things like that, he sends me back to the library. But that's part of the challenge. And one of the reasons why I enjoy talking with him so much is that he is... And see, I believe, now this is after a long struggle. I'm 78, and I've struggled through all kinds of revolutionary ideas. And I come to the conclusion that basically a democratic free enterprise system is the best way to deal with poverty in this world.
Is this something that became most apparent when you were mayor of Atlanta? Because you could be a lot more theoretical in those other jobs, but when you're running a city, you really have to think about getting investment and the like.
Well, and that was when it began. Well, it really started because we were building a mass transit system, and I wanted to be on the mass transit committee in Congress. And mass transit was under housing, and housing was under urban affairs, and urban affairs was under banking. So I ended up on the banking committee. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time I began to be challenged to understand how the global economy works. Well, when I became mayor, I understood how pockets of money, surplus pockets, exist around the world. And so I got a lot of flack because I never went to Washington asking for money. I went to Tokyo, I went to Geneva and Zurich, Switzerland, I went to Amsterdam, London, and I invited people to come in to invest in Atlanta. We actually brought $70 billion worth of private investment into Atlanta in those 8 years. 1,100 companies moved into Atlanta. And we created 1 million new jobs.
And did it change the lives of Atlanta's poorest citizens, especially African Americans, as much as you'd hoped it would?
It did. And But nobody believed it at first. And the black community used to get on me, particularly about traveling all over the world, and they'd say, none of us are going to get these big jobs you're bringing in here. But now if you go into a high-rise building in Atlanta that's a 50-story building, and I used to carry a camera with me, I would take pictures of the people who were on the construction site, and they'd be black and white. There'd even be women climbing those things, rafters working. Now that you, it takes 5,000 jobs probably for persons at least 5 years to build a 50-story building. Then once it's built, to fill those offices and those office jobs, you got another 6,000 or 7,000 people working. And I had to translate that. Every hotel room that we added, 2.5 jobs are created per hotel room in Atlanta. And when we started, we had 2 Marriotts. When I ended up as mayor, we had 74. We probably now have 120 hotels. And our biggest employer of poor people is the convention and hotel industry, as it is in New York.
You tell a funny story in the book about a time a parking attendant at a hotel refused to take a tip from you.
Well, the mayor's salary in Atlanta was $50,000 a year. And I tried to give this guy a dollar for parking my car, and he said, look, Mr. Mayor, keep your money. My tips are more than you make. And that's the key to it. I spent a lot of time still in Atlanta. I still live there. And I see people who have worked in these hotels, in these office buildings, in these jobs that I've known for 30, 40 years. And they may not be rich, but their children have had an opportunity to go to college. They tell me what their children are doing. Because one of the other things we did in politics in Georgia was everybody wanted a lottery. So we said, we'll have a lottery if the lottery goes strictly to higher education. So we created a HOPE scholarship fund so that any kid that gets a B average and 1100 on the SAT can go to any Georgia college free. So it gave poor people a chance to know that they could get an education. And there's some phenomenal stories of kids that would never have had a chance that we have been able to work with and just see miracles performed.
My guests are Andrew Young and Kabir Segal. The book, Walk in My Shoes, Conversations Between a Civil Rights Legend and His Godson on the Journey Ahead. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Kabir Segal and Andrew Young, who have collaborated on a book called Walk in My Shoes, Conversations Between a Civil Rights Legend and His Godson on the Journey Ahead. It's published by Macmillan Palgrave. And you've both written books before. Andrew, you wrote a memoir and a book about the civil rights movement. And Segal, haven't you written a book about jazz and democracy?
I did. That book was really about how jazz musicians, the United States Department hired jazz musicians in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, really, to go trumpet democracy abroad in colder countries. And they were kind of almost despised at home, but beloved abroad.
Well, Louis Armstrong was never despised, but he was considered the great ambassador to the rest of the world.
Right. In some quarters, often he was. I found research where people, they thought of him as kind of a clown figure, and he was just kind of clowning around. And what happened was when these jazz musicians went abroad, it was really the first time that American civil society was integrated. People say baseball with Jackie Robinson was the first time. It was really when Benny Goodman played next to Louis Armstrong that this concept of jazz as a democratic forum really emerged. It was America the Beautiful up on stage.
He hired Teddy Wilson and Lionel Hampton, and that was a great moment. You play jazz as well?
I do. I'm a jazz bass player, and I still play around town. You can find me at the Vanguard or some nights in the Blue Note as well.
When you're not on Wall Street?
Right.
Well, I suspect that J.P. Morgan pays a lot better than the Village Vanguard. Although there used to be a singer named J.P. Morgan, but that's a whole other matter.
Well, there's a lot of people on Wall Street who love the music, and I've developed many client relationships through music, and I'm in a band with a portfolio manager of a hedge fund, and we kind of jam together, and a lot of people come into finance because they're passionate about, you know, learning and markets, and that was one thing that inspired me. But everything I ever learned, I learned in a jazz band, I feel.
Jazz band is all about collaboration. What about the collaboration with your Uncle Andy? Did you have any disagreements about what should be included and what should be left out?
We did, and it was, you know, you mentioned Hank Jones earlier. He passed away. Hank Jones is kind of like a number two for a lot of large part of his life. And I was talking with Uncle Andy, and he always said, listen, it's great to be number two, and, you know, before you say something, you should be prepared to know what you want to say and wait till you get your 15 minutes of fame. And in collaborating with this book, we try to figure out what to say exactly. I was often pushing him to say, you know, he promised me I'll tell you exactly what you want to hear or what you don't want to hear sometimes and be honest with you. And as long as you ask the questions, I'll be honest. And sometimes the honesty was in the form of expletives or was in the form of naming some names. And
we can't use some of those words on the air, but they're in this book.
Right, right.
Well, yeah, but the part that in talking to him, I wanted to be intensely personal, and I wanted him to learn. And so I use specific illustrations of friends of mine and people that I've worked with. But I those are people I love and people I know, and I don't want to trumpet or criticize them for their mistakes or their problems. And so I didn't want to name names and tell stories. I'd tell stories, but not name names.
But you left in all the language because you thought that was more authentic?
Well, just that's, you know, Uncle Andy doesn't speak to me, I don't think, like a reporter. I don't think he would normally answer hypothetical questions. And because of our, I think, strong relationship, it was just this is what he calls boy talk. And an older guy talking to, like when I ask him about love and romance, he basically shares with me what he went through.
He didn't tell you about the birds and the bees?
Did you?
No, but I tell you what, we talked about, I mean, because he comes out of an Indian tradition where marriages are arranged, and he's now living in an Ivy League tradition where anything and everything goes almost. And so we had a very good debate, I think, on that, so much so that he pushed me to realize that maybe my marriages have been arranged. Though it was not, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but parents have a way of manipulating you behind the scenes, and I was encouraging him not to resist. Not to say I can't do anything my parents want me to do. Though it's important sometimes to say this is something my parents want me to do that I can't do.
He intervened actually, taking this whole arranged marriage concept and introduced me to a girl down in Atlanta. I have no game. That's probably something many girls realize.
Well, that's not true.
So no, but he did. He herded me into a car and brought me and introduced me to someone. So I think he's been trying to arrange something for me as well.
No, but I have a real thing about, well, I talk in the book about Martin Luther King's wife and my wife growing up in the country and being really strong women, see, that had much more adversity in their lives growing up than we had in our lives, see. And it's important to marry a woman that's strong enough to hang with you in these difficult times if you're going to be on the cutting edge of anything. And I've been fortunate. I was married 40 years the first time, lost my wife to cancer, and I've been married 14 years since then. And always to strong, independent, intelligent, and beautiful women. And it's not hard to do if you know what you're looking for.
Well, I gather you like Michelle Obama more than you like Barack, and you did support Hillary Clinton, at least in the early days of the campaign.
I have this thing about strong, smart women, and I do like Michelle, but not like Barack.
Even now.
Even now.
Because her position on the Miranda? No,
because she is a product of a family that was poor, that struggled, that her father had multiple sclerosis but never missed a day of work. I mean, that's a character-building upbringing. She has been put to the test. Her brother's book is very interesting about a game of character. And I knew more. I could identify more with her and her upbringing than I could with him, because I didn't know what he went through in Hawaii, and I didn't know what he went through in Indonesia. So as I got to know, I mean, I appreciate him as really almost the person I think of that is most like the spirit of Martin Luther King, in the sense that I've never seen him get angry. I did see Dr. King get angry, but only at me. But in public, he's the quintessential cool. He makes Miles Davis, you know, look like a rowdy.
Miles could be rather mean.
He also said he thought God or someone was looking after Obama when he drained that three-pointer shot. Right?
Yeah, I said, you know, when he was over there in the middle of the campaign and just walked out on the basketball court, and he was about 6-8 feet behind the three-point line, and threw up the basketball, and it went right in. I said, "Uh-oh, God is with him." And,
because when you play with Dr. King, you said you used to play with him, and everything used to go in.
Everything. When he would shoot, everything would go in.
Well, there's a lot of religion in this conversation. Kabir, you've written that Andy often advises by anecdotes, like Jesus.
Well, like Jesus, like parables. I think that's the line. And he always has like some sparkling stories in what I say is a museum of a mind. So he's been everywhere. He talks to everyone, and he always seems to have a fitting story. And I think that was the great kind of lesson. And we talked earlier about this whole idea of finance, and it's the whole concept of the Jericho Road. I can't get through one conversation in this book without talking about economics and jobs, because the March on Washington was called the March for Jobs and Freedom. Mm-hmm. And Dr. King, you know, he used a metaphor, a financial metaphor. Jesus spoke in parables. Dr. King said, listen, the Negro was given a check, and that check was marked insufficient funds. And they took that check to the Bank of Justice, and it was, you know, it was void, and there wasn't enough funds. So,
but he went on to say, but I still have a dream.
That's true.
And the thing that people do is they talk about the dream, but they forget about the bad check.
Mm-hmm. So he talks, and Dr. King said, and Andy also echoes this, that he said, I don't want to be a good Samaritan. I admire the good Samaritan, but I want to change the Jericho Road so people aren't beat up in the first place. That's an example of Andy using a metaphor to advise.
Many people regard your Uncle Andy as an icon of the civil rights movement. Do you remember when you first realized that your godfather was a widely respected civil rights leader and politician?
I think, you know, I don't know if there's a definitive moment, but I think I think maybe when I was maybe 10 years old, I brought him into my third grade class, and someone asked him, what car do you drive? Do you drive a Lamborghini? And Uncle Andy said, no, I drive like a Ford Taurus or something. And all the people in my class were asking me questions like, you know, did you play sports or something? And it was really then that I think all people my age were realizing, wow, this is actually a legend in our class. Because you know, you were just kind of always around with my father and my family, and I was so fortunate to have met you so early on in my life.
You met because you had worked in the same company as his father?
Well, actually, we met when his father took the initiative to introduce me to the Indian ambassador when I came up here to the UN in 1977. That was before he was born. And the Indian ambassador, Ambassador Ricky Jaipal, had been around the UN for 20, 25 years. He'd worked very closely with Ralph Bunche. He had known Gandhi personally as a boy, and he wanted to meet me, and so it was his father who got us together for lunch. And Ambassador Jaipal decided that he could teach me things and tell me things that the State Department would never tell me. Good example. I had a very good relationship with the Russian ambassador, and I worked on that because the Russian ambassador turned out to have been a student at Swarthmore College.
Well, which one is that?
Ambassador Troinovsky. Oh. And he was a tennis player. So we played tennis regularly, and we were good friends. Ambassador Jaipal said, now, you have a good relationship with the ambassador, but you can't get him to agree to anything unless you get the KGB lined up too. Well, nobody at the UN told me who the KGB people were at the UN. He knew. And so it meant that I knew a lot of the I knew where all the old bodies were buried. Mm-hmm. And when I wanted to know something, and one of the weaknesses of the U.S. at the U.N., we change ambassadors every 3 or 4 years. And so there's nobody around that's been there 15 or 20 years. The people who are most effective at the U.N. are people who've been there a long time and know how that system works.
And a couple of our U.N. ambassadors have been hostile to the U.N., openly hostile to it. I can't imagine that endears us to the other countries.
Well, it doesn't. And I was not only not hostile to the U.N., but I love the U.N., and I always made myself available to talk to anybody about everything. And we got everything we needed to get done at the U.N. when I was there. I never had a Russian veto or a Chinese veto because my wife invited the Chinese group over to dinner at the Waldorf. And we served them fried chicken and black-eyed peas and cornbread and mint juleps. And we had friends for life.
Now, I understand that your relationship wasn't totally mentor-student. You became his unofficial computer guru.
Right, right.
This is a generational thing. Mm-hmm. You knew how to hook those things up.
But I was better helping him than he was better helping me. I'm still...
That's probably true.
You're still trying to figure out how to get onto the internet?
Well, no, but I got stuck with the iPod and audiobooks because at my age, my eyes get tired after a while, and I can't read for long hours like I used to. So I do what I can do, but You have to be able to see clearly to handle today's computers.
This book includes some stories I'd never heard before, some rather touching ones like the one in which you moved a group of policemen and firemen to tears when you dropped to your knees to pray instead of fighting back after they refused to let you load a group of 5,000 marchers to the Birmingham jail in which Dr. King had been imprisoned. Are these stories that you've been telling over the years?
I have, and they some of them are in my other book on the civil rights movement. But the thing is, people see nonviolence as turning the other cheek and not fighting back. They don't see the power of the moral initiative of praying for your enemies in front of them. But the other thing, other power factor, was that we had 300,000 black folk that didn't buy anything but food or medicine for 90 days.
Back to economics here. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today, talking about Walk in My Shoes, conversations between a civil rights legend and his godson on the journey ahead. The people in question are Andrew Young and Kabir Sehgal, and the book is published by Palgrave Macmillan. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.